There was a family here from St. Louis last week, and they brought me a copy of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Now, I don't know why I didn't see it on another paper. Sometimes I'm so busy, I actually miss reading the paper these days, and I love to do it, and sometimes I miss. But the headlines were, House OKs Posting of Ten Commandments. That was 8 days ago. Now, it's interesting to see how difficult a problem it presents to this country to post the Ten Commandments. Before I comment more on that, I would like to read an article that I received from a party in Restored who sent me on email the following, and it's Paul Harvey's portion of his commentary on his radio show, and it's about Columbine High School. Actually, this is from a lady in Denver. She sent it 2 or 3 weeks ago. For the life of me, Paul Harvey says, I can't understand what could have gone wrong in Littleton, Colorado. If only the parents had kept their children away from the guns, we wouldn't have had such a tragedy. Yeah, it must have been the guns. It couldn't have been because of half our children being raised in broken homes. It couldn't have been because our children get to spend an average of 30 seconds in meaningful conversation with their parents each day. After all, we give our children quality time, 30 seconds. It couldn't have been because we treat our children as pets and our pets as children. It couldn't have been because we place our children in daycare centers where they learn their socialization skills among their peers under the law of the jungle, while employees who have no vested interest in the children look on and make sure that no blood is spilled. It couldn't have been because we allow our children to watch on average 7 hours of television a day filled with the glorification of sex and violence that isn't fit for adult consumption. It couldn't have been because we allow or even encourage our children to enter into virtual worlds in which, to win the game, one must kill as many opponents as possible in the most sadistic way possible. It couldn't have been because we have sterilized and contracepted our families down to sizes so small that the children we do have are so spoiled with material things that they come to equate the receiving of the material with love. It couldn't have been because our children who historically had been seen as a blessing from God are now being viewed as either a mistake created when contraception fails or inconveniences that parents try to raise in their spare time. It couldn't have been because we give two-year prison sentences to teenagers who kill their newborns. It couldn't have been because our school systems teach the children that they are nothing but glorified apes who have evolutionized out of some primordial soup of mud. It couldn't have been because we teach our children that there are no laws of morality that transcend us, that everything is relative, and that actions don't have consequences. What the heck? I'm just reading what he says here. The president gets away with it. Nah, it must have been the guns. Quite an article. Quite an article. And probably any two or three of those points of what it couldn't have been would be the substance of a good child rearing or family values, family relations type of sermon, which I know I need to give. Now back to posting the Ten Commandments. A lot of people realize because of that problem at Columbine, something's wrong. It's obvious nobody can agree on what, and everybody thinks it's some other problem. It's sort of like who's Laodicea? You always start with the assumption it's somebody else somewhere else. Oh, there's a big problem with Columbine, but if you approach any one of those groups and say it's your problem, or any one of those causes and say it's this problem, they'll say, no, it's another. It's somewhere else. Well, they finally did decide maybe we should, in fact, have the Ten Commandments posted in schools. Guess what? You have Catholic congressmen, Protestant congressmen, and Jewish congressmen. And up jumped a Jewish congressman, Jerry Nadler of New York. If you remember him, he was on the committee that last summer that investigated what to do with the president, I think of the Judiciary Committee. Huge, big face, like a bull. I've never seen anybody built quite like this. Of course, everybody's face next to mine is round, I guess. But this guy's really a big face, and Democrat. And he said, whose Ten Commandments? Which version? The Catholic version, the Protestant version, or the Jewish version? They are different, you know. Well, of course, the Catholics merged the first two to kind of tuck idolatry behind worshiping false gods. So it kind of gets lost since they're so deep into that. And they split the one on coveting, number 10, into 9 and 10. An awful lot of Catholics in this country, they're saying, if you post the Ten Commandments, we want to know how you're going to cut them. Now, nobody seems to stop and really say, what difference does it make? If it's the same words, post the text and leave the numbers out. And let people figure out. I mean, it's real simple to figure that out. And, of course, the Jews actually say it a little differently. So, finally, they have kind of come up with a generic version that is satisfying some people. And it's basically... I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You will not make for yourselves an idol. This is number 2. I'm sure the Catholics won't like this. Whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or is in the waters under the earth and so forth. So they kind of follow that. Now, what's amazing is at the bottom of this notation, it says... to people who obviously don't even know where the Ten Commandments came from. The Bible says that God spoke these words to Moses on Mount Sinai so he could give them to the people of Israel who were seeking the Promised Land. This translation from the chapter 20 of the book of Exodus is from the New Revised Standard Version Bible, generally accepted by most Christians. The wording is slightly different in dozens of other and more beloved versions, including the King James, the Jerusalem, the Douay Rheims, that's the Catholic, and the Jewish Publication Society translations. The order of the first three commandments differs among Jews and Christians. Similar basic rules and slightly different language also were found in Deuteronomy 5, Exodus 33, and in Leviticus, according to Rabbi Mark Shook of Temple Israel here, which is in St. Louis. Now, what's interesting is right beside this long debate, and I haven't even read the article to you about the problems faced on the House floor, you have basically this article about how they arrested another guy who sold these assault pistols to the guys who shot up the school. And then right above it is an incredible, incredible article that is its own horrible commentary of the world around us. Survivors tell how 62 died in grenade blast. And here's a picture of a man walking into the room where his relatives were essentially rotted corpses in Kosovar. Even with her ears ringing from the blast of the grenade, Elhaim Mukali could hear the screams of women and children dying around her. The 14-year-old Albanian Kosovar girl, along with dozens of neighbors and relatives, had been herded into a first-floor room in a house in her family's compound. Then, she said, a Serb policeman opened the door and tossed in a grenade. In a haze of smoke, to a chorus of chaotic shrieks and cries, police then sprayed the room with gunfire, she said. She and five others managed to leap out a window, but everyone else in the room, 62 in all by villagers' reckoning, died in a tangle of bloody, intertwined limbs. So closely packed were the victims and so intense the carnage that blood pooled and dripped down through the floorboards, still visible 2 months later in dark streaks and splotches on the tile ceiling of a basement room just below. You can look into the picture and see spines and rib cages and bricks that fell down on top of them from the ceiling when the grenade went off. The grisly events in the village of Polak, 20 miles west of Pristina, the capital, came to light as the first NATO troops were moving into the area Thursday. It was one of many accounts of mass killings to emerge as Serb forces were pulling out of the province, a withdrawal that was to be completed by midnight Sunday. But even among what was becoming a numbing litany of cruelty, it stood out in its horrific details. According to villagers' accounts, the killings took place April 17th. When Serb police and paramilitary men blocked a group of people, most of them women and children, almost all of them members of a single extended family, from going to the adjacent town of Gokovac, where they thought they might be safer. Many were the families of rebels from the Kosovo Liberation Army who were away waging war in the mountains. Ordered back to their compound, the women and children went inside the house. It was raining, and they began drying their wet clothes, hoping they were safe for the moment. At 5 p.m., the Serbs returned. The head of the family, Sinan Mokoli, 63, was taken out in the courtyard and shot, along with his brothers. They pleaded for their lives. They knew we were going to die. We could hear them calling out, said Elhaim, this slender, long-haired girl whose flat, almost expressionless voice was belied by nervous hands that were never still, picking constantly at a blanket or blades of grass or the bandage on her ankle. The men's bodies were thrown, weighted, into the family well. When relatives tried to retrieve them 10 days later, they were too decomposed to be hauled out of the water, and some body parts remained at the bottom of the stone-lined 25-foot-deep well to this day. NATO troops who entered the village for the first time went to the family compound after hearing what had happened. They'd called in war crimes investigators and were taking statements and checking the area for landmines and booby traps. The room where the killings were said to have taken place was heavily charred, but a crater could be seen in the center of the floor where the grenade had hit, and the walls were pocked with deep pits. The Serbs torched the house after the killings and buried the remains in the forest, villagers said. On a sheet of plastic lay a pile of blackened bracelets, rings, and keys that villagers had plucked from the ashes. The villagers said they could not be certain exactly how many were dead. They still hoped a few more of those trapped in the room might have escaped. The yard of the compound and the porch of the house were strewn with belongings, clothes, children's boots, suitcases, the gold-embroidered bodies of a wedding gown that family members and police and paramilitary men had thrown from the windows before the slaughter. Nezer Hazi, 62, said his two sisters, brother-in-law, and 17 of his nieces and nephews were among the dead. He learned of the slayings 3 days later, and he refused to accept the accounts until relatives brought him to the three-story concrete house and showed him the bloody, charred room. When I saw this place, he said, only then I knew it was true. Now, that serves as an introduction to a subject that might sound like it does not relate, but believe me, it does. Take a look at the animals out in nature, brethren. There are approximately 1 million different creatures in nature, and there are about 30 million different kinds of insects. Now, every day, approximately 2 or 3 of these species of animals disappear forever. There are about 2 or 3 kinds of animals that existed last night that will be gone forever until God recreates them in the millennium, perhaps, by the time sundown comes tonight. And a considerably larger number of insects that will have disappeared this day. There are a lot of creatures out there, and God designed them in a remarkable way. For instance, look at a cat. There are cats in our neighborhood. Some of you have cats. I grew up with cats. We had 2 cats, Persians. One was dark, one was white. My parents named them Scotch and Soda. And somebody poisoned those cats, killed them, and then stretched them in our doorstep. Cats never survived very long at our house, but these were beautiful, beautiful cats. I remember as a child holding them on my lap and just petting both of them at the same time. And people made sure they killed them one at a time and then just stretched them at the door. So we'd find them as children. Loved those cats. We had another cat, too. Well, actually, several more cats. And cats are unique. What's his name? Bill, this comedian. I can't think of his name. Bill Cosby, yes. Cats are cool. They are cool. You know, they meow. It fits a cat when you hear a cat meow. There's just something about a cat that sounds right when you hear it purr. To look at it, it fits. Look at birds. They chirp. Snakes hiss. Elephants trumpet. Dogs bark. And it seems to fit. And you say, well, it fits because we're so used to seeing it that way. Maybe that's partly true. We're used to hearing it that way. You look at a cow, you just expect it to moo because that's all you've ever heard them do. But I don't know. I have a feeling that if an elephant came up and it opened its mouth, threw its trunk back, lifted its head, and chirped, I just don't know if that would sound right. Something wouldn't fit. if a snake roared, or if a cat stood there and its head jerked and it barked while dogs meowed, I don't think it would fit. Animal sounds relate naturally to the nature, you know, naturally comes from nature, to the nature of animals. They just do. I think the fact that an elephant trumpets, and a trumpet is a majestic, huge, powerful, deafening sound. I've said this before in the Feast of Trumpets, I think, here in Akron. It just fits. It fits. I don't know if a snake just came along and opened its mouth. It looks subtle. It looks cunning. Satan, of course, is a serpent. And it opened its mouth and it barked, or it roared, or it chirped. It mooed. It wouldn't sound right. It would not sound right. Now, with that as a backdrop, let's turn to Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5. This is really a prophetic verse, but it's very, very interesting. Isaiah 5. And we'll pick it up in verse 26. Isaiah 5, 26. Now, the context is really about Germany in prophecy. Take a while to prove that. One of the sermons I've thought about giving again are the sermons about Germany and prophecy. I may give those. It's a three-part sermon. Some have stood up and said there is no coming captivity. Mr. Armstrong fraudulently warned hundreds of millions of people. There is no German-led United States of Europe. The United States will ally with the beast, and a lot of just crazy ideas that are wrenched out of the scriptures. And I've often thought I ought to try to go back and go through those prophecies to nail down why that is so profoundly dead wrong. And one of the verses that would be used would be this one. And he will lift up an ensign to the nations from far, God will hiss unto them from the end of the earth. Now you can hiss and call bees. I guess there's a way to do it. I was out killing yellow jackets the other day, and I don't know if you can hiss to call yellow jackets. I was trying to knock down this thing they were building, hanging down under the entrance to my garage, and it's a white background. I picked up a black shoe on a hot day and smacked it and made a terrible black mark all over the white paint. And missed the bees, missed the yellow jackets. And I did not miss the white paint, I can tell you that. And anyway, I finally came back and knocked them off. And boy, they were chasing me around the yard. And I found out I could still run pretty fast at age 50. And I've been chased by hornets before for a full block. And they hit me 6 times one time. So I've learned to be more careful. But yellow jackets are pretty nasty. But not as nasty as hornets. They usually won't chase you very far. They would go back to what they were involved in. But you can hiss the bees. You know, you can call hogs. I guess in Arkansas they have hog calling contests. You know, suey, suey. They get these guys and stand up and yell, and hogs come charging. Or I guess hogs get real excited when they hear the right kind of suey. And not being a hog, I have difficulty understanding that, but I'll take it on faith that hogs know when they're being called. Apparently they don't know when they're being called by another hog because people can get them to go. Well, God will hiss to these bees, and behold, they shall come with speed swiftly. The Germans are known for a blitzkrieg, which just means fast as lightning. That's what blitzkrieg means. None shall be weary nor stumble among them. None shall slumber nor sleep. And when you study the history of the Assyrian Wehrmacht, just means war machine, and you look at 3,000 years of pattern of the way the Assyrians, you know, the ancient progenitors of the modern Germans, fought, they are probably the greatest fighting machine the world has ever seen. There's little doubt of that. They don't slumber and they don't sleep. Neither shall the girdle of their loins be loosed. They're ready for war. Nor the latchet of their shoes be broken. It was only by the hand of God that the two greatest Gentile fighting machines, and history shows this, the Japanese and the Germans, could be overcome essentially by the ancient descendants of Israel, Jacob at the same time. No question about it. It's amazing how 100 million Germans, Austria, because they're Germans, and 80 million Germans, 20,000 Austrians, almost destroyed Europe, fighting basically on three fronts, not just the Eastern and the Western front, but there was a Southern front as well. They almost pulled it off had Hitler not gone a little too far, been a little too greedy, and let his hate for the Russians overcome his good judgment. This is a tremendous army that God is talking about, whose arrows are sharp and all their bows bent. Their horses' hooves shall be counted like flint and their wheels like a whirlwind. Well, that is the Blitzkrieg. Their roaring shall be like a lion. They shall roar like young lions. Young lions roar a lot. They actually do. They love to test their voice. I don't know, it's kind of like young boys looking in the mirror. They like to see muscles that have never been there before. You know, boys will stand and look in the mirror. They'll flex their arm, and here will come this pea up under the skin. And they wait for the day, because the Proverbs say the glory of a young man is his strength, that the pea turns into a walnut, and the walnut turns into an orange, and eventually the orange turns into a cantaloupe or whatever they want it to be under the skin, you see. Yes, they shall roar and lay hold of the prey and shall carry it away safe. Now, not safe to the prey. It's the death of the prey, because, and none shall deliver it. It's safe to the lions, not to the prey. For them, it's death. If you saw the movie The Ghost in the Darkness, true story of 101, 102 years ago, and I think I mentioned this in a sermon just a few weeks ago, these two lions, one called the Ghost and the other one called the Darkness, killed hundreds of people and dragged them up into this lair in the hills near this area where this bridge was being built. Val Kilmer starred as the real-life person who was the engineer in charge of the bridge project, and that's worth seeing the movie. You'll learn more about lions in that movie than you can possibly imagine, and you'll see why I say it might be worth seeing. I don't know about little children. And in that day, they shall roar against them like the roaring of the sea. You ever heard the sea roar? I've listened when I couldn't sleep. I remember sitting up late at night at the feast in 89 in Daytona. And it was very cold, and there was a tremendous east wind coming in, and listening to the waves roar. It was brutally cold at the feast in October in Florida, and I'd never seen it like that. They said they'd never seen it like that, and I couldn't wait to get back north after the feast so I could be warm. But anyway, I listened to the sea roar, and it wasn't a hurricane. It's just you could hear the roar. I've watched waves crash on the rocks above Duluth, Minnesota, and Lake Superior in a storm, and listen to the waves of that lake roar. And it's you know, you can understand the roaring of the sea. And if one look into the land, behold darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened in the heavens thereof. Lions roar. When a lion opens its mouth and roars, it's a fearful sound. I think I've been to most of the zoos in Ohio. I grew up, and I've told you, I went to the Toledo Zoo many times. I think my mother says the first time they at least took me, I was about two. And I told you the story of not being able to see the elephant because it was so big. Well, I can remember being in the zoo like it was yesterday, walking through periodically. We'd go back, you know, go under this road, and still remember under the road into the zoo. I don't even know where the zoo is now. I haven't been there for years, but hearing a lion roar in the zoo, there's this thunderous sound periodically that you hear because somewhere in the zoo, thankfully, caged lions would roar. Lions roar when they're not hunting. And I've often thought, what if there weren't one-inch steel bars protecting me in that zoo from a roaring lion? And, you know, sort of like the movie, The Ghost in the Darkness. You'd have to see the movie to appreciate what I'm kind of alluding to here. But you're in the zoo, everything's caged except there's a lion loose. Big zoo, might not find you, might find somebody else. You hear it roar. And if you do hear it roar, at that point it's not hunting. Lions that are hunting don't roar. They just don't roar. They don't make their presence known. That should be pretty obvious. But most people don't think that through, and that's an interesting facet of lions. Now, there are three schools of thought about Satan the devil. If you'll turn to 1 Peter chapter 5, there are three schools of thought about what the devil and his demons are, that you find out there, by the way, and they, to a degree, creep into the church. They're in the churches of the world, and they're all three wrong. They're all wrong, and I've watched people view this roaring lion that 1 Peter 5:8 calls him in the category of one of these three things, and they're all wrong views of the devil, and to the degree he can have you or I thinking stereotypes of him that don't exist, we're in trouble. Now, 1 Peter 5 and verse 7 says, "Cast all your care upon him, for he cares for you." It's a great verse to remember when you're discouraged and feeling burdened. "Be sober, be vigilant, watch, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may," does not say will, "seeking whom he may devour." Now, that's quite a statement. That's what the devil does. Now, you either believe that or you don't. Impersonal you. I'm not talking about any one person. We all either believe it or we don't. It's like any other verse in the Bible. We're finding out a lot of people have read a lot of verses a lot of times and didn't believe it at all. Now, we either believe that there is this being who is a roaring lion who wants to eat people, wants to kill them, or we don't. I remember being in New York City when the director of the work in South Africa came and gave a sermon. And he was telling the story of this foolish tourist who walked out into the bush, not that far, but walked sufficiently out into the bush to film this lion, saw the lion, and stood there with his camera. And a great many people were watching, hoping he would get this good picture. He had this terrific camera, and he was standing there waiting for the lion to pop up again. Nobody saw the lion sneak around behind him, absolutely leapt on him, tore him to pieces in front of his family, literally shredded him in front of his family, because he was looking for the lion this way, and it came right around behind him, between the people who were watching and him facing, looking for it. It crept around in the grass. Now, even the fact that a lion can do that is its own interesting point, which we'll talk about in a moment. What do you learn when you see that verse? What can you learn when we read this verse, that lions, Satan as a lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour? Now, again, it's not will devour, because will implies Satan's will determines who he kills. He just says, "I want that person," and takes them. "I want that animal," you know, a lion might say that, and takes it. Well, no, lions can't always capture or kill the animals that they seek. All you have to do is watch some Disney movies to see that lions don't always succeed, and I'll tell you why. As a matter of fact, lions actually know when they no longer can get an animal before the animal would seem to be aware of the fact that the lion is trying to get it. Lions can sense when an animal is no longer able to be caught, and I'll talk about what happens when that takes place. There's an interesting verse in Jeremiah that actually is something hunters of lions have long since understood. What can we learn from this verse? Look at Luke 22. Kind of a sobering verse, particularly if it applied to us instead of the person about whom Christ said it. Luke 22 and verse 31. "And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, Peter, behold, Satan has desired to have you." Now take out "to have," and just says, "Satan has desired you." Four words. "That he may sift you as wheat." Now, I've mentioned before, and maybe even recently, it seems like I did, I've sifted wheat a few times. Not many times. My wife used to buy it in bulk, and we'd have a gallon jar of it. And you have to sift through wheat, pick it to pieces, literally. Every single grain, you have to pick out all the junk. I won't go back through that because I mentioned it in a recent sermon about some other subject. But having sifted wheat, oh, I hated to do it, but I'm glad now, looking back, that I did, because I'll never forget what Christ meant when he said this to Peter, that Satan would like to sift you as wheat. You have to pull everything apart to make good bread. My wife makes bread. She makes a lot of bread, and it's really good bread, and it can't have a lot of other stuff in it if it's going to be good bread. Sometimes hard kernels get in there. I bit down onto a piece of bread this morning, and I bit something. It was like biting glass. You ever bitten glass? I have. That's the worst thing in the world you can bite. I'd rather chew sand or eggshells or something than glass. But I have prayed for you and that your faith fail not, and when you are converted, strengthen your brethren. Now let's stop for a moment. What if Satan, Christ said to you, wanted to sift you? I wonder how I would react if I heard, literally, Satan wanted to sift me as wheat. Now, in reality, he does, and the same is true of you. He will constantly watch you to see if he may devour you. If your will allows him to fulfill the may devour on his part, if you will open yourself up to him. Obviously, we have to pray for one another that this does not happen. That'd be a pretty sobering thing if you stopped and realized periodically that Satan wants to literally rip you to pieces like that lion, the foolish tourist in South Africa, because he does. And he'll do anything in the world he can possibly do to accomplish it. I've watched people through the years, and I gave a facsimile of this sermon. Actually, I gave the essence of this sermon in a sermonette in 1970 when I was at the end of my junior year of Ambassador College, just a sermonette. And I have learned through the years and watched some of the research that I did about lions that composes this sermon. I've watched it play out through the years in the lives of many of God's people who take the wrong approach toward the reality of just exactly who and what and how Satan functions. There are three schools of thought about the devil, and they're all common, and they're all wrong. Number one is he does not exist. He literally does not exist. He is sort of a figment of theological imagination. He's sort of the epitome of evil generally, that's personified in a kind of a being with maybe horns and a pitchfork or a serpent or whatever, and he just really doesn't exist. But so that people can picture evil, people down through time have slowly developed, depicted, and characterized evil as though it's a being named the devil and Satan. There's an awful lot of Christians who actually believe they don't exist. We're going to find out that attitude sort of crept into New Testament circumstances that Christ found himself in. It's why Christ had to constantly cast demons out of people. A couple problems that Christ dealt with. I'll tell you about the other one. And you see them commonly. And there's a reason why it happened. It was not by accident. The second reason, or second way that people sort of view the devil is like, is it Hal Lindsey who wrote the book, Satan is Alive and Well on Planet Earth? I think it was his book. Somebody wrote that book, forgot the title. Well, this is the idea that every little teeny tiny thing that happens is caused by Satan. Satan is not only real, he's so real that everything that happens is attributed to him. The toilet backs up, Satan's trying to get at me. There are people like that. The people who see Satan around every corner, under every rock, and behind every tree. And many times when it's their own human nature causing problems, they will literally believe that it's the devil. It's sort of part of the devil made me do it. Wouldn't have been I made me do it. It's the devil made me do it. Now, let's think about this. I remember sitting on a visit a long time ago. I was an assistant, actually, at the time. And I watched this man in the middle of a visit, another minister there, and a roach went up the wall. There are sometimes really odd people you visit. Well, here's proof. And right in the middle of the visit, this other minister and I sitting around his kitchen table, he turned and rebuked the roach in the name of Jesus Christ. Now that's a little strange. He said, the devil's in that roach. He's trying to distract this meeting right now. He didn't even ask the ministry what they thought, if we have the gift of discerning spirits, but that's what he did. And I remember another minister who was, I'm sorry, actually this was a minister, I'm sorry, he was defrocked later, who was sitting at a table, and a mop fell in a closet during the visit. And he turned and rebuked the mop. I visited this man later on after this incident had been kind of the tip of the iceberg, and this man had to be removed from the ministry. This was 20, 25, almost 30 years ago that he was removed. I visited him later. I was transferred in. I turned out to be his pastor, and he was no longer an elder, but he had faithfully remained in the church and died in the faith. And he believed that Satan was in there stirring up the mops in the closet because he wanted to disturb this visit. Well, people sensationalize, they will sensationalize the devil and make him into things that he isn't, and what it does is the same problem as number one. It obscures what he really is. Now, the third thing that the devil becomes is sort of a kind of a Casper the Ghost, boogeyman, again, this spook, often horns and a pitchfork and jokes about him, and that's sort of the way he is. That he really does exist, as opposed to the people who say he doesn't and maybe depict him that way, they sort of see him that way. That he does exist, but he's kind of a bad or a bigger, a worse Casper the Ghost. That's sort of the way people see him. All right, now, the reality, brethren, is that they're all wrong. There is a being out there who drives people to do the kinds of things that were done at Columbine High School. Nobody actually talked about the fact that the devil could have been involved in those shootings. When you see cult murders take place, animal sacrifices, yeah, there are places around here, they find them in the woods. Right here, northeastern Ohio. There really are people who are literally into worshiping the devil. They know exactly what he is, and they want more of him. But you have to know what the devil is and how he really functions to properly resist him. Now let's talk a little bit more about lions. But first turn to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. And when he had called unto him his 12 disciples, verse 1, Matthew 10, he gave them power against unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal all manner of sickness and all manner of disease. All right, now, if you understand, and it's its own, I guess, message to explain the difference between sickness and disease. They're actually different Greek words. I wish I had time to go into that. But he gave these 12 disciples, soon to be apostles, power over demons. Now, you don't see a lot of this kind of problem anymore. I mean, a lot of demons literally are medicated, and they're away. You don't see them as often in society, but there's plenty of them out there. Don't doubt that. But he gave them power because they were so rampant at the time of Christ's ministry. Two problems were sex and demon problems. You find Christ constantly dealt with both. Now, why? Why did that happen? Well, beginning about 400 years earlier, the descendants the priesthood, the remnant of the priesthood of the Jews. Eventually the Pharisees, I guess, were the most like this. They said, do not teach about sex and demons. In effect, what people don't know can't hurt them. So don't talk about demons and don't talk about sex, or you're going to inspire people to get into it. It's sort of ignorance is bliss. Don't say anything. Well, what people don't know can hurt them, and if they don't know things they should know, then ignorance is not bliss. But the idea was sort of that it was. It was bliss. Don't tell people. Well, guess what happened? When people were not armed with knowledge of how demons worked, they got terribly involved in them, and Christ knew that one of the ways to deal with the plague in society in a way that would bring attention on his ministry and on those who were to be apostles was to give them power over what had become a rampant problem in the 30s AD, all through the land of Israel. Okay? What people don't know about the devil can hurt them. We're not to be ignorant of his devices, the Bible says. Now let's talk for a while about how do lions hunt? What are their strengths? What weaknesses or limitations do they have, if any? I think you all know the story of how the lion is the king of beasts. It's a lot of stories about it. I once heard a joke. It was kind of a funny joke, but it illustrates a point. This lion was walking through the forest one day, and he saw this little warthog. He just roared. This warthog is just, you know, shaking and trembling. He said, who's the king of the beasts? The little warthog said, you are, Mr. Lion, you are. He said, well, see that you never forget it. And he kept walking along, and he comes up with this little deer. And said, who's the king of the beasts? The deer says, you are, Mr. Lion, you are. See that you never forget it. He goes on down the trail and comes to this elephant. Looks up at the elephant, roars at the elephant, long and loud, said, who's the king of the beasts? The elephant cocked one eye, raised his trunk, snatched the lion up, lifted him up, swung him around three times, slammed him this way, slammed him that way, swung him again, threw him against the tree, and knocked him cold. And the lion woke up, blinked, the elephant still standing there, and he says, well, you don't have to get so angry just because you don't know the answer. Well, maybe the lion is the king of beasts, unless he runs into an elephant, I guess, is what you conclude. But let's talk a little bit about the strengths of lions, because there's a lesson here, tremendous lesson. Matter of fact, a fascinating lesson for Christians. First of all, lions have great speed. They are one of the fastest creatures on earth. Now, probably the only two animals that are faster are greyhounds, maybe whippets, and cheetahs. The fastest human being in the world can run 100 yards in 9 seconds flat. Now, that's fast. I imagine maybe a little faster, because nobody runs 100 yards anymore. Now guys run 100 meters, and they, if you compute it, basically, I think 9 7/8 the world record, if you computed that to yards, probably they'd be around 8 9 now, would be the world record. But that's the best that was ever done. But lions have been clocked running 100 yards in 4.7 seconds, almost double the speed of the fastest human being on earth. And that's tremendously quick. When you think of a football field, think of the Cleveland Browns and that football field, 4.7 seconds a lion can run 100 yards from a dead stop. It can run that fast. So they have great speed. By analogy, a human being cannot outrun the devil. Where you are, he's capable of being, period. You can't outrun him. Number two, they have staggering, tremendous strength, more than you might realize, and it manifests itself in a couple of ways. For instance, their strength as it computes to leaping. they can, from a standstill, leap 10 feet straight up in the air onto a tree branch. I've watched pictures of Walt Disney when a lion catches a gazelle, and eventually you get down to the lion's right there, and the gazelle will leap in the air. I've watched a lion literally leap straight up and snatch the gazelle 10 feet off the ground. I've actually seen the pictures. I read about it, but having watched Walt Disney's films as a kid, it's true. Tremendous ability to leap. They can leap 30 feet across a ditch from a standstill. Now, the longest leap any, you know, broad jump any human being has ever done, running as fast as they can, is about 29 feet and 1 inch or 3 inches. I've lost track of the record. I don't know if anybody's ever beaten Ralph Boston's record. I think he was the guy who broke the record in Mexico City. He jumped in that thin air and, you know, jumped like a foot beyond the record. And it may not have really been fair, but that was the record. Well, nobody's ever gone 30 feet. I know that. Carl Lewis never did, and he was the greatest in the world for a long time. Tremendous ability to leap, to drag prey. If you, again, if you saw the movie The Ghost in the Darkness, to watch a lion grab a human being and run with the human being, run with the deer in their mouth. I mean, a deer is a pretty big animal. I was talking to Bob Bacher this week, he hit a deer. Amazing, his deer destroyed the front of his car, basically. But jumped out in front of him because another guy made a maneuver, and these police came, tough deer. Took 6 bullets in the head by the policeman, 9 millimeters, to kill this deer. That's tough. And so anyway, deer, pretty good size, pretty tough animal. I've seen lions run with a deer. Literally run with a deer. Now, their paws and their jaws are extremely powerful. Typically, a lion will jump up on top of an animal that they have caught. Literally, sometimes, if it's a big animal, and they will bite right through the neck at the shoulders sometimes, and literally crush right through and paralyze the animal, crush right through the spine, muscles, everything, and take a bite out. The animal drops like a rock, and then they kill it. So, there's no question that a lion has tremendous strength, stronger than a bear, really. They can swipe and just literally disembowel an animal in one swipe, much like a bear. That's number 3. Number 4, they're camouflaged. You look at that brown savanna grass that's yellowish and brown through much of Africa. There is a camouflage that is there that basically is natural to a lion's color. That's how the lion can creep around and do what it did to that tourist. It's how lions can essentially go unseen by animals because they know that they have to basically hunt downwind from animals. And as long as they do that, they're not going to be detected by the animals that they're pursuing because they will drop down and they will literally, you ever seen a cat going after something? They will. It's just natural to the feline species or kind of any species. They will crawl on their belly and inch forward, and they can go great distances and stay low until they're ready to spring. Number five, lions are good swimmers. You know, it's been said cats don't like to swim. Lions do not like to swim. It is true, they don't. But they actually will swim. If they're going after prey, they will swim across a river. They've been known to swim rivers or swim out onto an island in a river to catch prey and kill it and then swim back from the island with the prey. So lions aren't shy. They may not like to do certain things, but they're not above it. They will swim. Number 6, they have a very strong sense of smell, way beyond human beings. They have just a remarkable ability to smell things. I mean, you and I are designed, we can smell obvious smells. You know, human beings have noses. Well, of course, we don't hunt with our nose. We don't have to smell animals far away, so God didn't build it into us. Lions do, and they have the tools to smell at great distances. Also, sight. They have tremendously good sight. It's been said a hawk can see craters on the moon. A hawk can essentially see with the power of the 6-power binoculars. And a hawk can literally see craters on the moon. I guess they've watched the way they will hunt for mice. A hawk will look down and see grass bend a certain way in a field where the wind is blowing, and they'll see the grass just move. Now, how many blades of grass would move? A hawk can tell there's a mouse there and will go down and get it. Now, that's remarkable. Lions are pretty much as good. They have a tremendous ability, tremendous sight. So there are, right there, 6 different strengths. Now turn to Jeremiah 4 and verse 7. Jeremiah 4 and verse 7. I mentioned we would go to Jeremiah, and we'll do that now. Jeremiah 4, verse 7. Now verse 6 says, "Set up the standard toward Zion, retire, stay not, for I will bring evil from the north, and a great destruction." This parallels the Isaiah 5 verse we read earlier. The lion is come up from his thicket, and the destroyer of the Gentiles is on his way, and he's gone forth from his place to make your land desolate. Okay? Now, the lion has come up from his thicket. Typically, when a lion is ready to strike, it will drop down. They will stay in the thicket, try not to be seen, and they will wait there. The 7th and last great strength of lions is they are extraordinarily patient. You have to be patient when you hunt them because they're not easy to find many times, but they are very, very patient when they hunt. There's a reason they're patient. I'll explain why. They actually know about a weakness that they have, and therefore they have to be patient. I remember a gentleman by the name of Dr. Singh. He was a man that Mr. Armstrong had met in India. And Mr. Armstrong sometimes would ask people to come and address the students. Dr. Singh, S-I-N-G-H, came to speak to the students, and he was talking about the fact that he had hunted game in Africa. He had hunted lions. And he made an interesting statement. He said, "I have been hunting lions at the time they were hunting other prey. I've observed them," and he would sometimes hunt them with cameras as well, or shoot them with cameras. A lot of people, that's the way they hunt. But anyway, he said that he wanted to relate to us this story that he had seen several times play out when he was hunting lions that were themselves hunting prey. He said, "A lion knows when it's been discovered. Even before the animal it is preparing to strike, pursuing, runs, the lion can tell that the animal knows it's there and knows it's far enough away that it need not yet flee. But the discovery, the exposure, is clear to the animal. The lion will literally stand up," you've seen it over and over, "tuck its tail between its legs, turn and trot away in a fashion," he said, "that could only be described as sheepish. That it'll crouch, it will wait with great patience, and as soon as the lion sees that it's discovered, stand up, tuck its tail," it's remarkable, "and will turn and trot away." Now certainly Satan is very patient. He's waited 6,000 years to subvert God's plan. It's the subject of a whole sermon. Why does Satan continue to fight God? It's because as a deceived being, and yet knowing that he is brilliant, brilliant but deceived, Satan actually believes at the last minute he's going to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, and he's going to subvert God's plan and win. So he's very patient, and so are lions. And they will walk and wait patiently to take prey. But there's another reason why they have to be patient. And it's why a lion will never roar when it's hunting. The lion's roaring, you're safe. As a matter of fact, prey know that. They know when lions are roaring in the vicinity, they're basically safe. A lion will never roar when it's hunting because of one great weakness that they have. And that is Lions have absolutely no endurance whatsoever. Now, they weigh 500 pounds, and they have great strength. They have all these other abilities. They can run with tremendous speed. But a lion, even unlike a cheetah, which is also a cat, cannot run very far, very fast. And if you've ever seen pictures again, and I've read about this as well, lions pull up many times when they're chasing prey, and it looks like they're about to catch the prey. I've seen the pictures. It's absolutely remarkable. A lion will pull up after it's chased the prey and close the gap and close the gap because it's about to get it, and they pull up and give up. And the reason is, experts say, lions know they absolutely don't have the juice to finish the chase and catch the prey because lions are very limited in endurance. Now back to 1 Peter chapter 5. They just don't have the ability to keep going. This tremendous, powerful, 500-pound animal that's a killing machine if you get too close, can leap long or high, has no endurance. Now it says this lion walks about seeking whom it may devour. Verse 9, whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world, the cosmos, the society. That's a very simple statement, brethren, but it is profoundly important that you understand why those three little words, key words, will often save your life if you employ them properly against the lion that wants to take out you and I. Now, whom resist steadfast? I have noticed through the years, and if you think about it, you may have noticed the same thing if you've employed the principle. If you are under tremendous temptation, usually you are in the presence of something that is more than just of the flesh. If you resist according to the scriptural formula, that intense pressure will usually let up very quickly. It's remarkable, but when you understand what we just said about lions, you'll understand why God says, whom resist steadfast. Just hold in, resist. Lions cannot stand resistance. Satan cannot stand resistance. He has no endurance. He is a lion. And like all lions, he doesn't have the ability to endure. That's why you could, at this point, branch off, in a way I'm not going to for the rest of the sermon, give a whole sermon on endurance, and you'd understand why enduring is so important for a Christian. Now, for another reason, it's the way you defeat the devil. You usually don't hear a sermon about he that endures to the end, the same shall be saved, tied to resisting the devil, but it could be its own sermon. If you want to endure against Satan and defeat him, that's all you have to do is endure, but you've got to do it God's way. You can't have a misunderstanding of how Satan works. So then, understanding that lions, Satan, has no endurance, who can he catch? Who then becomes eligible prey for the devil? I'm going to, for the balance of the sermon, give you quickly seven different categories of people who can be caught by the devil. We're going to move relatively quickly. Number one, the lame. Turn to Matthew 9. Those who are spiritually lame, like an animal that is lame, obviously can't outrun the devil. Those who are lame. Of course, the point is real simple. Don't let yourself become spiritually crippled or lame. Matthew 9:14. Then came to him the disciples, John, saying, why do we and the Pharisees fast off, but your disciples fast not? And Jesus said unto them, can the children of the bride chamber mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom shall be taken from them, and then shall they fast. No man puts a piece of new cloth into an old garment, for that which is put in to fill it up takes up the garment, and the rent is made worse. Neither do men put new wine into old bottles. else the bottles break, and the wine runs out, and the bottles perish. But they put new wine into new bottles, and both are preserved. And both are preserved. Well, obviously, the bridegroom's been taken away. That's Christ. We're going to marry him. He's gone. The instruction is, and then shall they fast. Now, brethren, we bring our conditions into the church. We have to fast to draw close to God. We bring our problems, our infirmities, spiritually speaking, into the church with us. When we go underwater and we're baptized, you don't come up completely spiritual. You come up about 99.99%, as Mr. Armstrong used to say, carnal. That's natural. And we need to understand that you have to work on your spiritual infirmities, because Satan will never strike you where you are strong. He will strike you where you have problems. If there is a limp in your spiritual gait, he will see it and know that he can run you down. You won't be able to outrun him. He won't need much endurance to catch you or me. That's category number one. You cannot remain spiritually lame. You have to figure out where you are crippled in your life. With God's help, he will reveal it to you, and you have to, with God's help, become whole. Now, to fear God and to keep his commandments is the whole man. You have to become whole and not crippled with God's help. Number two, the weak. Matthew 4, turn back a couple pages. Obviously, those who are weak, they may not have a particular lameness, but if they're very weak, in a sense, their whole body's lame. Then was Jesus, Matthew 4, 1, led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. Well, you know, it was 40 days and nights, and he was tempted over and over again. And this exchange between Christ and the devil, who quoted Scripture, Satan knows Scripture. He can throw Scriptures into your mind to try to get you to get to be confused with what you should do. You know, you can actually use a Scripture to give yourself a freedom you're not supposed to have, to get yourself to do something you're not supposed to do, think something you're not supposed to think. A Scripture can come to mind, and it may not have been sent by God. This is proof right here. And, of course, you come down through the context. In verse 9, after he'd shown Christ all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, he said to him, "All these things will I give you if you will fall down and worship me." Then said Jesus unto him, "Get you hence, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." So he resisted him. Now, why did Satan attack him after 40 days and 40 nights of fasting? You'd think that Satan would say, "Wow, he's close to God. This is the dumbest time I could ever go after him." But that the devil is, remember, the devil is a perverted mind. He's confused. He's deceived. So he looked down and said, "Aha, Christ is weak. I can get him." But Christ knew, like Paul said, when he was weak, he was strong. So he made himself physically weak so he would be strong in God and could therefore resist Satan. And he said, "Get out of here." And Satan did, because of the mental strength that God, through his Spirit, had given Christ. But the devil didn't see it that way. He thought he was weak. "I can get him now, and I can subvert the whole of God's plan." And, of course, the devil was incredibly stupid. He took on Christ at the very worst possible time, when he had fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. But it was prophesied that this would happen, and Christ knew that it would happen, so that's why he fasted 40 days and nights. Number three, turn to Matthew 13. Lions and Satan go after the young. They go after the young. Now, the young typically remain in the middle of the herd. Young animals can run fairly fast. You'd be surprised. I was watching a little horse the other day. It looked like a plow horse, a mother, and it was chasing its mother. It's a small horse, but you can tell it's cute. A little plow horse and it was running after its mother. And I mean, its mother took off, and this little squirt came running right behind it and did pretty well. I was impressed, and I'd been watching this little horse. I was born earlier in the spring, and it was really clicking right along. It was a plow horse to start with, and not a thoroughbred. Well, obviously, young animals can run fairly fast, but they need to stay in the middle of the herd where they will not be seen as much by the predator, you know, the lion who is out there hunting in the grass. Matthew 13 and verse 4. And when he sowed, parable of the sower, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the fowls came and devoured them up. Then some on the stony places, verse 7, some among thorns, verse 8, some seed fell into good ground. Now you come down to verse 20. And he that received the seed into stony places, the same as he that hears the word, and anon with joy receives it. See, lots of people receive God's word with joy. There will even be some who may come with us, real excited. Wow! Even hearing the word of God that they've sort of lost track of for years, real excited, but they don't endure it because they don't stop and realize how hard it's going to be to walk with us. I actually expect this to happen. I think there'll be some people who will come with us, and a handful of them will quickly drift away. You'll say, "Ooh, that's harder than I thought." They're excited that there's a place that's going to get back to everything they thought, but they can't go to a place where there's 150,000 people teaching everything that we once believed. And so there will even happen perhaps in a pattern again. Yet has he not root in himself, but endures just for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, by and by he is offended. Also he that received seeds among the thorns is he that hears the word, and the care of this world and the deceit of riches chokes the word, and he becomes unfruitful. Well, you see, those who are new, they get excited and they kind of lose it. They just sort of lose it. You know, it doesn't take enough root. And obviously, if you go back to verse 19, there's even another verse that we could include. When one hears the word of the kingdom and understands it not, then comes the wicked one and catches away that which was sown in his heart. But that person never really got it. It's just that those who were among thorns and the stony places sort of did, but sort of got choked and didn't put down enough roots. I've watched trees burn up in summers where there's drought. When the city plants them down through the years, there's always the hope when the city spends a lot of money for trees that they'll root in before you have a drought, and often they don't, and that's what will kill a young tree. And people are the same. The young are very vulnerable. And in many respects, if you are young in the faith, some of you actually are, you will have to play catch-up for the rest of your life. You will have to really work very, very hard to not sort of fall behind. You'll have to stay in the main body of the herd. Number four, obviously, would be the old. Galatians 6:9, the old in the faith. Galatians 6:9 talks about people who kind of get tired, or as it says there, let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. Don't get tired because you've served for so long. Boy, that's frustrating to a pastor, and I think to anybody, to watch somebody serve and serve God, serve people, and they've done so much well-doing. They're going to reap a great deal, God says, if they faint not. They just simply get old in the faith. They don't have to be old physically, but they just get worn out. I talk to them periodically. There are people that just burn out, and some of them try not to, and they're able to overcome it. I was talking to a man the other day who read this little blip in the journal a week ago, and I wonder, will anybody see that? Well, a family far away in a large city in Canada did read it, and this man called me, and he's just been waiting. He's tried and tested the spirits and this group and that, and he and his family are looking for a place to go. And I think perhaps we'll, you know, maybe be with us. We'll see. I hope so. We had a long talk. Well, some people just get old and tired and say, look, again, you've heard me say this, men lied to me again, so I don't have to obey God. I'm just tired. I'm old. I've been through this. I'm weary. Don't do that. Number five, the sick. Some people can become spiritually sick with an attitude. 2 Corinthians 2:11, I alluded to, we won't turn there, says not to be ignorant of Satan's devices. Satan has many devices. An unforgiving attitude is one. A critical attitude, a judgmental attitude is another. Boy, do we live in the age when everybody wants to pick everybody else to pieces like chickens in a barnyard. It's just the age we live in. Nobody's ever guilty of anything. Everybody else is guilty. There are no perpetrators on earth anymore. There are just victims. I don't know how you could have a lot of victims unless you got perpetrators. But nobody's a perpetrator. They're just victims. Nobody's an offender. Everybody's an offendee. And so people can get into that attitude. People can have an angry attitude, a hateful attitude, a bitter attitude, an arrogant attitude, proud attitude. Don't tell me. And they, boy, those are just deadly. I've watched them sweep people away. And people just thought they could hold a wrong attitude and somehow they could just keep on going. Invariably, the Bible's right. When people have wrong attitudes, those wrong attitudes swallow them. They do. And so if you have an attitude, think of it as a sickness. Even out in the world, they say, man, you have an attitude. I never heard that until about 20 years ago. You have an attitude. But people can have attitudes. And attitudes swallow people up if people do not, with God's help, swallow the attitude. Please don't let attitudes, this could be a whole sermon, swallow you up. Number six, those who are sleeping. Animal that's asleep, an animal that is asleep, is a classic candidate for the morgue. Okay, Romans 13 and verse 11. Romans 13 and verse 11. And that knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. Now, if that was true in Rome, how much truer today in the end time? You'll remember my sermon 6 months ago entitled The Sleep in the End Time. I just am amazed at people's ability to go back to sleep. You can wake them up and they can be on fire, but they're just so drowsy and it's so easy to sleep and so many other people are sleeping. You know, and we're not to let the night put us to sleep. For truly we can say, if they could in Rome, now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day's at hand. You got to get up, keep going. Romans 11, verse 8. Romans 11, 8. According as it is written, God has given them, those of the world, the spirit of slumber. Eyes that they should not see and ears that they should not hear unto this day. They're awake, but they're asleep because their eyes and their ears don't work like somebody who is asleep. God has done that, but he's not done it to us. We're supposed to be awake. We're supposed to be watching. I mean, watch. Go through your mind like a computer, through data. What attitudes are in here? What could take me out? Just constantly comb through and scan your mind. Wait a minute, well, that's a wrong attitude. No, that's got to go out. And just deal with it. Don't just fall back into attitudes that creep in. Well, you know, I'm just too hard. I've been hurt, and I'm just proud, and I'm not going to get over it, and I'm not going to forgive them. Don't do that. Keep watching. Be vigilant. Remember what it says? Be vigilant. Satan is vigilant, looking at who he can devour. Be vigilant so he can't make it you or me. And category, the last category, number seven, fringers. Fringers, people who are off on the edge. I used to see this more in the past than now. There'd be people who came to church, and that's all they ever did, was come to church. They never came to anything else. And when they even came to church, they came in, sat down, and sat right there, and that was it. And then basically, when services were over, they walk out. They didn't fellowship before or after, never came to a social, never came to club, never came to Bible studies. I don't like potlucks, didn't do that. And so, never served. They were on the fringe. They were away from the edge of the herd. Well, guess who is a candidate for a lion? Lions don't attack from the middle of the herd out. They attack from the outside the herd in to the edge. A fringer can be very healthy, doesn't have to be lame or weak or old or young or sick, can be wide awake, but he's just flat out too close to the edge of the church. So many people down through the years just drifted across the line on out of the church because it was just one step away in their conduct. Somebody who's busy, who's involved. I remember a minister once saying something that he never employed himself, but I never forgot it when I was a freshman at college. He said, I want to be so involved in God's church that I couldn't leave. It would just change my life so much I couldn't leave. And I watched him slowly forget his own advice over about the next 8 years, and he left. And this was a man who had been utterly paralyzed. He had been totally paralyzed. A piece of shrapnel had gone right through his spine in the Korean War and just cut it. He was totally paralyzed in a wheelchair. He was anointed, and he was healed instantly. He was healed absolutely instantly, got out of the wheelchair, and was a testimony to the power of God healing him. He was my freshman speech teacher at Ambassador College. He said, a guy like that could never fall away. It's a remarkable story. Well, anyway, there are people who just sort of drift to the fringe, and out they go. They drift to the fringe, and out they go. People will fellowship in cliques. They'll fellowship in little groups, and they sort of don't reach out for other people. They don't care about the rest of us in the body of Christ. You know, you have the main body of a herd. Well, we're not a herd of people. We are certainly a flock of sheep that has a body. We're the body of people that make up the church that is the body of Christ. So there is a body of the flock. And as wolves would hunt on the edge of a flock, lions also hunt sheep. No question about that. Mountain lions hunt them and kill them all the time. Certainly we have to be aware that we do not want to be fringers. A couple of final verses. James chapter 4. James 4. And verse 7, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. He will flee from you. Now, that's what it says. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. He can't stand a protracted battle. It may be intense, but it will be short, and if you apply this formula, brethren, you and I will win. Now you must draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. It doesn't say God will draw near to you, and then you reciprocate. It's the other way around. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Why? Why is that in that context? That's one way you resist Satan. You clean up your life. You draw near to God. Purify your hearts. If your mind is thinking two different ways, purify it. You double-minded. Be afflicted. That's fast. Remember we read that earlier? Mourn, weep. And periodically, yes, our laughter must be turned to mourning and our joy to heaviness. I wish Christianity was always fun. And I've said in many of the updates, I want it to be fun again. It's even in the booklet I talked about it. But brethren, it can't always be fun. You know, God did not design life, so it's always a party. It's always a formal dance. That's just not the way it can ever be. Let your laughter be turned to mourning sometimes and your joy to heaviness. If you're in a war against the devil, focus on the war. Focus on the war and make sure that you win it. Ephesians 6 and verse 10. Ephesians 6 and verse 10. Final verse. Finally, my brethren, Ephesians 6:10, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Now, that's important as a setup for what we're about to read. Put on the whole armor of God. Put it on. Now, will you? Or won't you? Will you put it on? That you may be able to stand. That you will be able you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Now there's a real clear conclusion that if you put on that armor and stand in God's might, you will be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. You'll resist it successfully. But turn the coin over. If you don't, you won't. You won't be able to resist it. Now, why do you do that? Because it's a given that we wrestle not against flesh and blood. We're told to war. We're told to fight. But, brethren, we know we don't do that with human beings. In the world, they do. That's why the guy threw that hand grenade in there. That's the way they think they fight. But if they understood what they were really wrestling against and succeeded in that battle, they'd never throw a hand grenade in a physical battle against flesh and blood. The world has never figured out who the God of this world is, who has deceived the whole world. But we have to figure out that we do wrestle against principalities and powers. Well, I haven't wrestled against the governor of Ohio recently, or the president, or any policeman. It's talking about the rulers of the darkness of this world against wicked spirits in high places. And I'm going to ask you a question as we come to the conclusion. Have you thought today or yesterday or even in the last 3 days that you have been at various times doing nothing less than wrestling with demons, the principalities, wicked spirits? That's what it should be translated. Wicked spirits in high places. That's what it says in the margin. You know, you may wrestle with wicked spirits tonight before the day is over, or tomorrow. They're not going to come in and say, I'm a wicked spirit and I'm here to wrestle with you. They won't roar, neither will Satan when he tries to get you. He'll be very quiet and he'll come in subtly and try to catch you and hope that you're tired, hope that you've caught a spiritual flu and you're sick, hope that you've twisted a spiritual ankle and you're lame. Hope that he can get you because you're just sort of, I'm not sure about where I should be. Maybe we should be looking at numbers more. Maybe we should be in a bigger group. I just don't know if the body of a group that's just a few hundred in size, I don't know. How could numbers be so wrong? And you forget exactly what prophecy says. What the battle is about. That is so clear when you look at the Bible and you get away from human reasoning. You see, do you recognize that all of a sudden somebody could do something to hurt you and wham, you could turn right around and forget that you are wrestling against a wicked spirit who'd like you to get angry, get bitter, get nasty? Brethren, we have to continually keep on resisting. I remember watching Spencer Tracy in this remarkable movie as a child called The Old Man and the Sea. Ernest Hemingway wrote the book. I didn't think much of the book. It bored me to death. But when I saw it in the movie as a child at a theater, I liked it. You know, he caught this fish. He dreamed of this fish, and he caught it. Of course, you know the end of the movie was he brought the fish back to show it to everybody, but sharks ate it up, and basically all that was left was the head and the tail of this marlin or something. I forget what it was. Hadn't seen it for probably 40 years. But anyway, he fought this fish and fought it and fought it and fought it. What, a 200-pound man. And eventually he overcame this giant fish because he would not give up. Spencer Tracy was a great actor, and it made it a terrific movie. And to watch that struggle as a child made just a dent on me. God had not called me yet, but I never forgot it. And I later related it to the battle that we face. You can't give up. I've watched people say, I won't give up, and then they do. I've watched people say, I'm here for good, and I've watched them leave the church 48 hours later because they simply don't believe in the end, in the final analysis, they really do have to apply these verses and resist and fight wrong attitudes, and they leave. Satan tires easily at stiff resistance. Resist him, and he will flee from you, and you will win the great battle we all seek to win.